The Irish writer Roddy Doyle won't give up his day job. Since 1979, he's taught English and geography to high school students. But the publication of his three novels have made him into something of a darling of Dublin, especially since his popular first book, The Commitments, was made into a feature film directed by Alan Parker. His stories are set in a working-class suburb of Dublin, not unlike the place where Doyle lives now. The popularity of his books come from its humor and true-to-life colorful language. They revolve around the Rabbit family. In The Commitments, Jimmy Jr. forms a soul band with other unemployed and semi-employed wannabe musicians. In the new novel, The Van, Jimmy Sr. finds himself out of work and aimless. Doyle is visiting the U.S. before school starts, and I asked him if the story of Jimmy Rabbit Sr. is a common but ignored one.
Yes, it is very much. I was largely inspired by the sight of middle-aged men roaming around where I come from. I got a lot of holidays as a teacher, and I'm very fond of bringing my son out. He's only 18 months, but I bring him out as much as I can. If I bring him down to the park, the place is packed with these men by themselves, just roaming around, obviously staying out of the house until they can go home. The libraries, whenever you go into them, again, there's men. They're not involved in any sort of a study. They're in out of the cold, you know, and I find it very moving, and it makes me angry at times, although I think my anger is probably worthless. So it's in a way I harnessed my feelings about these people generally and about some particular people that I know and tried to make a book out of it.
Well, did you know people that you made then this rabbit family out of it? Is it based on people
that
you know?
It's not based on real people, but I come from an area of Dublin called Kilbarrick, which is just north of the city centre, and the area has a 48% unemployment rate. So if I pick up a stone and throw it, it's going to hit somebody on the dole. And 48% isn't the worst statistic in Dublin either. There's an ironically named place called Jobstown with an 80% unemployment rate. Yes, 80%. It's staggering, and it's actually frightening to drive through the place, not because of fear or anything like that, but the utter emptiness of the place. So it's based on, luckily, on second-hand observance, if you like. I am very, very lucky insofar as I've never been unemployed for a day. And in fact, if you take writing to be a job, I have two jobs rather than one.
And that makes you very unusual then.
In Dublin, yeah. Increasingly unusual.
Let's start back in the beginning and talk a little bit about how you began with The Commitments and where the idea for that story came from.
It was about 1985. I decided I wanted to write it. I wanted to write a novel with young characters in it, and I looked around for a plot. Dublin is a very rich place as far as music is concerned. If you know, again, if you go into Dublin Street, fling a stone, you'll hit a drummer. You know, as far as I can make out, virtually every kid under the age of 21 is in a band, has been in a band, has just been thrown out of a band, is starting a band. It's quite amazing, really. The other idea I thought of would be the story of a football team, but a friend of mine had already written a wonderful play about a football team, so I didn't want to ape him, and as well as that, it would be all male. And it would be less entertaining, I thought. So I decided the career of a band would be a good, simple story, you know, starting and then ending. And I just happened to be listening to a lot of soul music at the time. And had read Jerry Hershey's wonderful book, Nowhere to Run, and Peter Goralnik's book, Sweet Soul Music, and was listening to James Brown. And I was just totally immersed in it, and I decided it would be a soul band. Had I written the book a year earlier, it would have been one of these country punk bands. I don't know if you remember Jason and the Scorchers. And that's what I was listening to the time beforehand. So anyway, I thought it'd be the possibility of imposing a black American culture form on top of Dublin. The potential for humour was there. Also, it would be a bigger band than normally. You know, a lot of bands are just three or four young men. It would be a big band with a brass section. And most importantly then also, there'd be the backing vocalists with three women. And immediately you've got the sexual tension. And so it worked.
Well, you know what I really loved about the story was the fact that it didn't have this happy ending of this band, you know, leaving, going off to Hollywood as the sun set over Ireland.
Well, that was important to me. John Sutton, this man who set up the company with me, he had actually done some research on bands. And the career of the average career of a band in Dublin is the lifespan of a band is 9 months, it would appear, like a pregnancy. And that was the reality. And also, most of them disappear without trace. You know, I know countless drummers that I used to teach that I might meet on the train. And in the 2 months since I've met them the last time, they've been in and out of five or six bands, you know. So, you know, there's for every U2, there are thousands of bands that are sometimes marvellous, but never, for some reason, take off. And so I just wanted it to be typical. So it's not a huge, big, dramatic story. And I wanted it to be honest, and I hated the idea of them becoming hugely successful, you know.
My guest today is Roddy Doyle, and he is the author of several books about the Rabbit family. And the first one began with a book called The Commitments, which was made into a movie. That was followed by The Snapper, and now he's out with a brand new book called The Van. He is a teacher, teaches English and geography in a school. It's kind of a junior high school combination in Ireland. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is writer Roddy Doyle. Now, let me ask you, what was the effect on your students when not only did you write this book, but then this book became this fabulous movie? Did they turn you into a celebrity?
No, not really. See, I've been a teacher a lot longer than I've been a writer. So I've been there since 1979. So I sort of my reputation as a teacher is solidly founded, you know, long before I wrote. I think they get a great kick out of the idea that somebody they know goes on telly now and again or on the radio or my picture's in the paper or something like that. And I think they're a little bit proud of that in the area generally, you know, that somebody from the area has, I suppose, has, you know, even temporarily has attained a certain amount of fame. Not that it wasn't anything I wanted in the first place, but we had a great day a week before the film was released in Ireland, in that we hired out a cinema and bused the kids to the cinema, showed them the film, and then sent them home. There was no school for the rest of the day. And it was a marvellous, it was a lovely feeling. I stood at the back of the cinema and they went berserk. They went crazy. There's a scene, it's a very short scene, where the three of the guys are going across a railway bridge. And the railway bridge is just around the corner from the school. And they went mad. Mm. I've never seen such an emotional reaction to a railway bridge. But they they went mad, berserk, you know. And one or two of them had the parts as extras. And I didn't realise this at all until, you know, during the market scene at the very beginning, there was a guy that I teach, like his head right in the middle of the scene. So they went mad for that as well. I think they recognised themselves and the place in it, you know.
What kind of a family did you grow up in?
I grew up in this place called Kilbarrick. At the time, it was very much on the edge of the city. Quite literally, when I went out the front door and out the gate, there was a farm right across the road. The city stopped, you know, at the gate. But as I was growing up, it was a marvellous place to grow up in because it's actually beside the sea, you know, surrounded by farms. It's very close to a fishing port and beaches and things like that. But as I was growing up, it changed dramatically because the farms were bought by the city corporation and they built housing estates there and private developers. And it became one of many big suburban areas around the city centre. My background, I suppose, would be, although I never gave it much thought, I suppose you'd call it middle class. My father had a job in the civil service, you know, a public employee. And so we never knew hard times. His job, you know, it's a permanent pensionable job. So I was never aware of recessions or anything like that as a child.
I read that your father was a sort of a quote unquote character. Is that true?
And still is, yes. He's a very funny, entertaining man. Yeah, very... just a very lively, colourful man, you know. He had actually a major operation in March, a double bypass. He had had a heart attack, and to watch him bouncing back now, he's coming back actually fitter and funnier than ever. And, you know, I believe it takes months to recover mentally as well as everything else. But he's a very lively, colourful character, very memorable person, and most people who know him are very fond of him.
And a good storyteller?
Yeah, a terrific storyteller. And again, he has an amazing memory. He remembers banners across the middle of O'Connell Street, some hilarious ones, things like Long Live the Sacred Heart and God Bless Christ, things that make absolutely no sense, regardless of whether you're Catholic, Protestant, Jew or Hindu. They don't scan. But he remembers these things, and he's a highly entertaining man. More importantly, as far as, I suppose, literature is concerned, he reads like an animal, an absolute animal. I remember seeing him reading a compendium of Graham Greene novels. And he finished one novel, turned the page and started the other one without stopping for breath. I would never do that, you know. I'd always at least put on the kettle, make a cup of coffee and then start maybe, you know. But never. He read like an animal. And then when I was still very young, he started passing the books on to me, you know. Never saying, read 20 pages and write a resume and, you know, tell me what it's all about. Just, if you want that, read it, you know.
And you did.
And I did, yeah. And there was never any ban on subject matter, you know. Books were never considered unsuitable for me. So I read some sort of fairly hairy stuff that I didn't even understand.
Like
really,
what?
You know? I remember when I was about 10 reading The Godfather. And I remember there was a particularly explicit sex scene on page 47. I even remember the page number. And I couldn't quite figure out. I knew they're doing the business here, so to speak. But I couldn't quite figure out how they were managing it and why. You know, I was, a couple of years later, no bother to me. But, you know, I was that bit young. But I was never told, you know, don't read that, you know. So It was actually, looking back on it, I've just been writing about it in a fictional sort of way. I was very, very lucky, I think. Hmm. Very lucky.
Are you going to keep writing about this rabbit family that you've written about in The Commitments, the snapper, the van?
No, I'm not. When I was writing The Snapper, as I said, I felt that there was another book in Jimmy Sr., but also equally strongly when I was writing The Van, I thought, that's it. It's a better book, I think, if you realise there are no further instalments, that he won't get up and start doing something all over again, that if I leave it to the reader's imagination, what happens for the rest of his life? I think it's more moving in ways. So I decided no. And as well as that, they are different in ways, but they're broadly similar in their style. And I wanted to see, really, is there something else in me, or am I sort of, have I stuck myself in an enjoyable rut, but a rut all the same? So with the new novel I've been writing, I set myself new rules and new guidelines and actually go against all that I, you know, set myself with those books. It's written in the first person, you know, so fictionally it is about me. It's not my real life, but I mean, I am the central character, so to speak, and it's through the eyes of a 10-year-old boy. And the storyline, the plotting is entirely different. It's more haphazard than the other books have been. So,
well, it's interesting that you say that, because in you kept talking about in this these books about the rabbit family that you wanted to keep yourself out. You said, I wanted to write myself out of this story.
Yeah. Now, in this case, I'm going the opposite direction. It is fiction. It's not about me as such. It's inspired in ways by childhood memories and things like, I got this rush of childhood memories when my son was born, you know, and lots of things came back to me. And I started using words, you know, affectionate words with him and my mother then called. And there were these words, she was using them. And I'd never known that they were in my head at all, you know, and where I'd picked them up. So in ways it's inspired by my childhood, but it's a fictional character. The worry for me, actually, what I'm scared about is that people will assume that it's me.
Yeah.
And not so much me, but that the other characters, you know, are my parents or my brother and sisters and what, which
they're
not. You
have to put a disclaimer in the front of you.
Well,
your
have to, but nobody ever believes then.
Right.
You know, what happens is that the parents' marriage starts going badly wrong. And I was thinking of actually having a photograph of my parents on their 41st anniversary in the front, just to get it established immediately that it's not my parents, you know. I mean, but that's a worry, but it's a fret that I'll have to cope with and climb over, you know, if it is to be published.
And you'll keep teaching?
For the time being, yeah. I still ask myself, you know, regularly, do I want to do this for a living? And I'm not as wildly as enthusiastic as, I suppose, you know, naturally as I was when I was 21. I'd say that I like going to work, but I love coming home. I seem to get an awful lot of work done as a writer with the limited time that I have. It seems to suit me. If I have an hour in the evening, I rush and I really do make use of that hour. So at the moment, I don't actually, you know, need to give up work. Possibly because I do have another outlet and that I do have, to an extent, two jobs. I'm very content. You know, I'm 14 years there now, so I've gone through two seven-year itches and I haven't felt the itch yet. But I think somewhere along the line, possibly in a couple of years, I'm going to ask myself in September the 1st when I'm going back to work, do I want to do this? And the answer will come back no. Mm. And I'll give it up the following May. You know, I'm in a position to do that now anyway. But at the moment, I'll keep doing it. I'd be worried if I gave up writing, as you know, as it's a very solitary occupation. You know, where would my inspiration come from? You know, so I'll keep it going for the time being. But I wouldn't like it to become a tyranny that I have to go to work because I have to have material to be a writer, because, you know, I'd be utterly miserable most of the day. It just wouldn't be worth it.
Ronnie Doyle, thank you very much for joining
thank
us
you.
Today.
I enjoyed that.
Me too, thanks.
Thank you.
Ronnie Doyle is the author of The Commitments, which was made into the movie of the same name. His latest novel is called The Van. This is Fresh Air.